This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're here in Tucson, Arizona. And if you've ever visited this part of the country, you know it can get really hot. And I'm not talking about the weather. I'm talking about the food. From jalapenos to Anaheims to poblanos, folks in this part of the world have been spicing their food with chilies for centuries. Something I learned on this trip out west is that chilies don't just make food hot. There are lots of mild ones, too, that are used in cooking. And chilies have non-food uses, too. We'll talk about all the uses for chilies. You know, for example, their signature chemical compound, capsaicin, that stuff that makes them hot, is also used for a pain reliever. I see you're shaking your head. You knew that. Yes. And their color is used in cosmetics with lipsticks. Do you know that, too? Yeah. Well, that's what we're here for, to talk about chilies and everything that you ever wanted to know about chilies. So we're going to kick off the hour talking about chili peppers, what makes them hot, and why do we like that? Why do we like something that's that hot for us and burns, well, maybe it doesn't burn our tongues? And how are farmers and scientists working together to take the plants from seed to fruit and back to seed? And here we are in the audience in Tucson, Arizona, talking to folks. And if you'd like to join us, please step up to the microphone when it hits you. The appeal to ask a question. Also, our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And in Second Life, you can find us on Science Friday Island and look for our seating area there and ask a question in Second Life. Let me introduce my guests. Jeff Silvertooth is a professor and the head of the Plant Sciences Department at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Thanks for talking to us today. Good to have you here. Ed Curry is a farmer and owner of the Curry Seed and Chili Company in Pierce, Arizona. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you.
And in fact, we have a little bit of a tour of Ed's chili farm just outside of Tucson at sciencefriday.com. Flora Lichtman, our digital producer, put it together. And if you'd like to see a little preview of the full-blown version, you can go over to our website at sciencefriday.com to see a bit of Ed's farm. Gary Nabhan is a research social scientist at the University of Arizona. He's also the author of Why Some Like It Hot, Food, Genes, and Cultural Diversity. And he joins us from WMEA in Portland, Maine. Thanks for talking with us today, Dr. Nabhan.
Happy to be here with you.
Thank you. Ed, when we say chili, what are we talking about? I mean, it encompasses a lot of stuff, doesn't it?
It does. Probably the simplest explanation for chili is obviously, a lot of countries have their own specific chilies. But here in the Southwest, long, green, once termed Anaheim, because they were so popular there around Anaheim, California, they responded to the cool weather next to the ocean there. Mm-hmm. But long, green chili, Dr. Paul Smith from UC Davis gave it that name, suggested that name some years ago. So long green chili indicates a relatively mild, flavorful chili.
Mm-hmm. Are there lots of different varieties and brands and things like that that you can get?
Of the long green?
Yeah.
Of the long green alone, there's several. My partner Phil V and I have bred several different strands of just the long green alone. But when you get outside of the long green, in the Capsicum annuum,
right,
species, it's huge. There's just all kinds.
Mm-hmm. Jeff's southeastern Arizona is part of what is called the chili belt. I don't think I've ever heard that phrase until I got here. What does that mean? Why is this a great spot to grow chilies?
Well, I think we kind of gave it that name. Sounded good. But it depicts some of the unique characteristics associated with the chili plants, particularly this type that Ed was describing, we call the Anaheim or sometimes the New Mexico type chilies. And this is a characteristic that is consistent with basically any type of crop, that they have their own environmental parameters or environmental conditions that they best develop and produce under. And whenever we take those kind of plants out of those optimum conditions, they can oftentimes still grow, but they don't grow at an optimum type of condition with regard to yield and quality. Mm-hmm. This area that's kind of what Ed and I refer to as the chili belt, or a lot of us do, is about 3,500 to 4,500 feet elevation, and it runs along about a 32-degree north latitude zone. Extends, in our case, from southeast Arizona, across southern New Mexico, into far west Texas, and the northern parts of Chihuahua, Mexico. But the whole area has those ranges of elevation in common, so it's a climatic and weather type of conditions that are really most suitable.
So the elevation is important.
Very much so. Very and it's really so. The temperatures and the climate. But elevation changes everything here in this desert. For example, we're at about 2,600 feet here in Tucson. If we were to go west to the Colorado River, we drop down to about 150 feet in Yuma, right above sea level. And we could extend all the way up to about 4,500 feet elevation in southeast Arizona, where Ed farms in the Sulphur Springs Valley.
So it's a little cooler, a little wetter up there?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. A little higher elevation. Yeah. Higher elevations mean you get a little bit more precipitation on an annual basis and a little cooler temperatures.
Mm-hmm. Gary and Abham, where do chilies come from? Chili peppers, are they native here? Were they imported? How did they get here?
Well, the wild chilies called the chiltepines are right there in southern Arizona, within about 40 miles of where you're standing. But chilies are all over the Western Hemisphere from Tucson all the way down into the country of Chile. And we have four domesticated species, some semi-cultivated things and some other species, a dozen other wild species. But people have been cultivating them for about 8,000 years in Mexico. We think the origin of Capsicum annuum is somewhere south of Guadalajara. We don't know whether it was on the western coast of Mexico or the central valleys or the Caribbean coast. But from there down is the probable center of origin of chilies for the most part that we grow in the United States. We have a few exceptions like the dátil chili pepper in Florida and the Tabasco that are different species. But Ed and Jeff are correct that most of what we grow in the United States is this species Capsicum annuum.
And they've been part of people's diets for a long time. When you dig up ancient
wild
sites,
chilies, the wild chilies predate even agriculture in the Southwest by 4,000 years. We find them in caves in what are affectionately called coprolites, the human manure remains in caves of prehistoric sites, and people can extract chili seeds out of those going back 8,000 years in the borderlands, right in this chili belt that Jeff and Ed are describing.
Ed, you breed chili peppers, and I have to say it's a great name for chili pepper breeder, Ed Curry, to be a chili pepper breeder. What kind of traits do you look for? I mean, give me the ABCs of breeding a chili pepper. I mean, there are a lot of different things you could choose for. What do you select at? What are you looking for?
We look for, specifically in the canning industry, we look to make it two-wall. I brought one here. Obviously, your radio audience can't see it, but we look for a two-wall, slim-type chili, which we've tried to make it a little bigger, a little girthier. Specifically, right now, we're trying to make the skin thinner. We're looking for thinner skin, so there's less waste product to the canning industry. We're looking for more yield. How we got on the map, Phil V and myself, well, Phil's just a renowned pepper breeder around the world, but how we got famous in this quote-unquote was by stabilizing the heat, and that variety was Arizona 20. As this industry spread to the north and to the east, and new connoisseurs of chili were coming in, they needed a standardized heat, because you know yourself, if you went to a restaurant one time and got a mild chili, and you went the next time and you got your head burned off.
Yeah.
And so when we standardized that, it made it, that was one of the first characteristics we look for.
Can you tell how hot a chili is by the color, if it's red chili versus a green chili?
Good question, Ira.
We Easterners don't know anything about chili peppers, so we're...
We Westerners don't either, especially those of us trying to make a living at it. Red doesn't mean hotter.
No.
Red is only a state of maturity. I said this on a Phoenix TV station some years ago that, you know, as a human, when you get old, you turn wrinkled. Well, a chili turns red. And it's just strictly maturity. The heat is developed. The capsaicin oil is produced right on the placenta wall of a pepper. And it comes down that placenta wall. The further down the placenta wall, obviously, the hotter the pepper. Many people think the seed are hot. Only true because the the capsaicin is rubbed off on the seed sometimes in processing. The seed in and of itself is not hot. It's strictly that oil that is developed along the placenta wall.
So the oil is not in the seed then? It's in the seed?
That's correct. The oil, if you cut a pepper, and I can cut one for the audience here, if you cut a pepper, you're going to see that oil, a little shiny blisters right along that placenta wall. And there is so many uses for that. And you'll probably ask questions later
You could tell us whenever you'd like to. But,
okay.
But let me ask you about this. When you cut the wall, you release that hot oil. How do you measure how hot? Is there a terminology or a standard for heat?
Scoville units.
Scoville. Who? Was there a guy named Scoville?
There was a guy named Scoville many moons ago that developed it. There's an HPLC tester that measures. And the beauty that God gave us in quantification is really neat because we're able to quantify heat. And yesterday we talked extensively with Annette about why is that important. When you go to the store and you buy a bottle of salsa and it's marked mild, medium, or hot, by standardizing that through the HPLC machine, we can actually give the customer the same heat level in every jar.
What's the range of Scoville units for those three categories? Is there something like 5 to 10 is 1, 10 to 20 something? You
know? Typically, I don't know if I'll hit this exact, but roughly probably mild sauce is going to be 50 Scoville units. Mm-hmm. Medium is probably going to be 150 to 200. Hot is going to be 500. Now, when you get over here to New Mexico and Arizona, and my friends at New Mexico State will all testify that you know it's eaten much hotter than that.
500.
But typically, like your Pace Picantes, your brand name, picante sauces are going to be in that range.
All right, we're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more about chili peppers. Maybe there'll be Scoville units on your menu someday to tell you how hot this stuff is. We could start that instead of those little numbers of chilies lined up, how hot it is. Stay with us. We'll be right back and talk more about chili peppers with Jeff Silvertooth, Ed Curry, and Gary Nabhan, and right here in Tucson. Don't go away. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the science of chili peppers with my guest, Jeff Silvertooth, professor and head of plant sciences at the University of Arizona, Ed Curry, farmer and owner of Curry Seed and Chili in Pierce, Arizona, Gary Nabhan is a research scientist at the University of Arizona and author of Why Some Like It Hot, Food Genes and Cultural Diversity. And Gary mentioned before, talked about a wild chili botanical reserve south of Tucson that is down there. I want to introduce my next guest, who's Jean England Neubauer. She is with us on the audience. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. It's great to have you here.
Tell us about this reserve.
Well, actually, my family's had the grazing rights on the Rock Corral Canyon down south of Tucson since the 1900s, and we also have a chili company called Santa Cruz Chili and Spice Company. So when Gary Nabhan came to me, and he and some friends, they've been out researching and camping out in the desert, and he said, I think up on your grazing reserve we found some very unusual chiltepines, and I'd like to go into cooperation and put together a biological reserve up there. So we were very, very excited and happy to work with Gary.
Mm-hmm. What do you do on the preserve? What goes on there?
Well, basically, it's just is an effort to protect the environment where these chilies, these chiltepines are actually growing. And part of the research we did is because we have a cattle grazing operation up there, we wanted to be sure that they could be compatible. And Gary came to us and said that they absolutely were compatible. And essentially, they're just there for us to sort of take care of and mm-hmm. make sure that nothing happens to them.
Now, chiltepines are some of the hottest chilies you can get,
right? They're very hot. They're very hot.
They're way over the 500 number that...
You know, I'm not sure. Ed, what's the Scoville on chiltepines?
Chiltepines probably going to be in the 50 to 100,000 range.
There you go. Right out. But they're great. They're full of flavor, and they are just a wonderful, you know, people use them sort of for medicinal purposes,
right,
in terms of firing up your menudo and things like that. That's very good for you.
So you don't want to ever bite into one of these?
Oh, sure you can.
To hum them themselves.
Sure you
can.
Sure you can.
Without a good...
Yeah. But you have to be careful.
You have to be careful.
Yeah, you have to be really, you really need to love your hot chili.
I want to thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today.
Sure.
And we'll be ready for questions later.
Thank you.
That's a hot chili pepper.
And as I think about that, I'm not exactly for sure on that. Habanero is 150 to 300,000, but a chiltepín is very hot. I don't know the number. I'll be honest with you. I don't know.
Well,
it's hot.
It's 50.
Go ahead.
It's 50 to 100,000. I think you hit it on the mark.
Oh,
so it's
Gary.
Thank you, Gary.
Several times less than the habaneros, and of course, many times less than this Naja Locia chili that's the reigning king of heat, which is up over a million Scoville units now, and it's a chili from India.
And people can eat that. Gary, are there certain cultures that are able to eat, you know, hotter chilies than others?
Cultures have become accustomed to this, but to eating spicy food, and in tropical climates, we have a number of cultures that seem to have a predilection for spicy foods, but there's something in the genes that make people non-tasters of certain bitter and spicy compounds, where other people, largely people from the northern latitudes, may be super tasters. So the same amount of Scoville units can affect two people, like my wife and I, very differently.
1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can go to the phones. We've got a couple of phone calls here, and maybe get some questions about chili peppers. Let's go to Patricio in Chicago. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi there.
I was wondering if you could talk about the difference between hot chilies and spicy chilies. It's been my experience that I like spicy because they're full of flavor, and the hot ones are just burning.
All right. Anybody want to take on that one? Jeff or Ed?
Well, it probably is a function of taste and semantics a little bit. Every type of chili has a different flavor with it. That would come from the flesh and the structure of the chili itself. And so a hot chili might just be, you know, within, say, 100 to 500 Scoville units. Extremely hot, spicy chili would be even higher than that. So it's probably just a matter of particular taste and preference.
Gary, any comment?
Well, there's many flavor compounds in chilies, and most good chili breeders like these guys are going for the flavor, not just the heat. And so we tend to spend a inordinate amount of time just talking about where they are on the Scoville scale, but clearly a habanero or a jalapeno tastes very different from the fine, spicy chilies that are coming out of southeastern Arizona and New Mexico that I feel have been selected for flavor over decades.
You know, we know that salsa has surpassed ketchup sales in this country. Is that a good thing for bringing back some of these wild chili varieties, Gary, that may be dying out?
Well, we have fragmented and declining populations of wild chilies where some of the land managers aren't as conscientious as Jeannie and her husband and her mother and father before them, who have been fine managers of the land where the wild chilies grow. But we also know from our Renewing America's Food Traditions Project that we have dozens of traditional heirloom chilies like the fish pepper and the dátil chili pepper and chimayo and el huique chilies from New Mexico that are now not only in decline, there's fewer and fewer farmers growing them, but we also know that they've been contaminated by accidental outcrossing with other varieties, so they don't have the always the characteristics that they were first bred for and known for. Their skin thickness may change or their flavor may change due to this accidental outcrossing with other varieties. So Renewing America's Food Traditions, based at Slow Food USA, is trying to get local communities to champion these different chili varieties as part of our cultural heritage, not just our natural heritage.
Ed, are you more interested in looking for some of these wild chilies or breeding your own? And are you breeding them, you know, in a new way or using the old Mendeleev sort of?
Oh, definitely the old way. Yeah. Definitely. I mean, Dr. Steve Hansen at New Mexico State works with us on possibly doing some transgenic things. But it's chili is very diverse genetically, and so it's very difficult. That has been a long process. But let me back up on that flavor profile just a minute.
Sure.
Gary hit the nail on the head. Thank you, Gary. There's many flavor compounds. Dr. Ben Villalone at Texas A&M spent years working on flavor compounds. And then Phil Villa and myself, Phil made many crosses. We took them to the farm, grew them out, segregated them, isolated them. For instance, a chili ancho, if you're familiar with ancho or poblano, tends to have a high rate of chlorophyll in it. It has a chlorophyll retainer gene. That in itself causes that to be a deep, dark green, gives it a different flavor. But then there's starch genes or sugar genes that when you start combining those, the fellow that called in and asked about flavors versus heat, that's exactly one of our challenges. Is years ago when Arizona 20 that Phil bred became the standard of the industry, that was a great yielder, a great canner, and the heat level was very stable in it. But the flavor was very bland. So then they came back and they said, hey, can you guys improve the flavor? So through crossing, and there's many, many types, but for instance, the Guajillo. The Guajillo chili is a high oil content chili. Dry, it has a much different flavor than it does green. We crossed the Guajillo with an Anaheim type, a New Mexico 6 type, if you will, and we got a complete different set of flavors out of that thing than we ever expected. So breeding is so fun. I feel so blessed to be able to work with Phil because through the years we've made so many crosses and seen so many different things. But that flavor profile thing is really, really an interesting subject. It's not just heat. Heat's important.
Right.
But it's not just heat.
Yeah. Jeff, we're here in the desert Southwest, and you mentioned that there was the chili belt. But would if you had to depend just on the rain for growing chili here, would you be able to do that, or you have to depend on irrigation?
We could probably keep a few plants alive, but we wouldn't do well with regard to yield and production from an agricultural standpoint. You know, farmers like Ed would have a hard time making a living on what they would produce just from natural rainfall, which across the chili belt is approximately about 10 to 12 inches a year in terms of annual precipitation. Mm-hmm. And these chilies actually require, and that's one of the projects we have right now, is to find out how much water do they require, when do they require that water, and what are the different rates of consumptive use, we call it, that they have over the course of a season. It's about 32 to 35 inches of water that the plant actually uses, what we call it through evapotranspiration or consumptive use out of the system. Mm-hmm. Much more, quite a bit more than what natural rainfall would provide.
I hear you. Okay, question in the audience here, sir.
I've always wondered, why do the wild chili plants have that heat? What advantage does it have for them? Does it attract fruit-eating wild animals or detract them before the seeds are ripe, or what's the deal there?
Gary, do you want to tackle that?
Well, I've spent about 15 years of field time on that one with my buddy Josh Tewksbury, who's been on Science Friday before. And what we found is that those capsaicinoids, the piquant compounds in chilies, repel mammals who would consume the seeds, and also they repel or resist molding in the fruit so that the seeds don't die that way. But ironically, the seed dispersers of chilies, which are a number of birds, including cardinals and pyroloxias, don't taste that heat. So ironically, birds, like some people, are non-tasters of the capsaicinoids, and so they readily seek the chilies out for their oils and their flavor compounds that they do pick up, and they benefit from the many rich vitamin compounds in chilies. So essentially, I say when my little son asked me why chilies are hot, I say, so birds can disperse them to nurse trees and other critters will not.
I'll tell you, my squirrels have no problem with them. I mean, I grow hot chilies, I thought, in my pots in my backyard, and I thought this will keep the squirrels out. But, boy, they're sitting there chomping on a green chili just to laugh at me as it's coming off the plant.
Can I interrupt here?
Sure.
Gary, I'll tell you an interesting story. In our cayenne breeding blocks, we had a problem with a particular cayenne that was too mild. And one year, my farm manager came by, and he said, man, did you see the deer really riddled that cayenne block? Well, upon closer notice, we found that the deer did us a great favor from a breeding standpoint. We were looking for hot. They ate every mild cayenne plant out there, and they left every hot one. It saved us 3 or 4 years in breeding work.
Wow.
Well, let me tell you another story about this interaction between mammals and chilies. When I worked at the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum, the great natural history zoo outside of Tucson, we had tremendous bills for bird feed in the aviary out there, and we realized that most of that bird seed wasn't being eaten by the birds at all that we were trying to interpret and present to the public, but that desert mice and house mice and rats had gotten into the aviary, and they were eating most of the food. So we laced the bird seed with food, and the next night and for the next week, the rats and the mice just disappeared from that aviary, and it was like chorus lines of mice and rats back in the desert again, trying to find food because they'd grown so accustomed to the bird seed, and we basically reduced the Desert Museum's bird seed budget by several hundred dollars a month by using the capsaicin to repel the small mammals.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flato in Tucson, and up the microphone, sir.
Hi there. My name is Matthew, and I've lived in Tucson now for 4.5 years, and this year I tried to plant in my garden only chilies because I wanted something easy. And they're trickier than I would have thought. That had a hard time making it through the summer heat. And like I have bunches of wilted ones now. I think I overwatered them. I mean, what I'd like to do is take you to my house and get you to...
Well, let me see if I can do this.
But my question generally is, what's good for chilies? And, I mean, how do I get them as big as the ones you brought in? And, I mean, but just generally, like, what kind of conditions? Are there tricks that I can use to grow better chilies?
Jeff, what?
Well, actually, you've got to hit a good point there. They're really sensitive plants, very sensitive plants. We talked about the climate conditions that they like, and they're kind of particular about not too high, not too low, not too hot of conditions, but just hot enough. And they're also very particular about their water requirements as well. So in this case we described a while ago, they use about 30 to 32 inches of water over the year. But we call a soil when it's full to its field capacity, or it's full of its water, like after you irrigate and the water drains away, we call that field capacity. And as the soil begins to dry, it drops and it's what we call plant available water level. Now chilies are sensitive. They only they will grow when it gets a little drier. But they like that range at about 75 to 80% plant available water to field capacity. Now, you take another plant like, say, squash plants or zucchini or tomatoes that you put in your garden as well. Now, they'll tolerate a drier soil. But if chili plants are sensitive to too much stress, then you overwater them and they're sensitive to that. They have kind of a, not really what I call, I kind of make fun of them sometimes, say they have kind of a weak little root system. They're hard-working plants if you actually can get them to fruit and do well. And that's what it's really kind of cool about watching guys like Ed and the good farmers that are dealing with this. They walk that fine line, that kind of razor's edge between not too much water but just enough.
Yeah.
And they're also sensitive to disease.
I've only got 1 minute to go. Ed, I want to ask you, what would be the perfect chili that you're looking for? I'll give you a blank check. What would you like to – how can you make it?
Well, I brought that.
Well, describe it. What makes it so perfect?
Two-walled, 6, 7, 8 inches long. A rounded shoulder. It needs to destem quite easily. It needs, for the canning industry, it needs to have a Scoville unit of 50 to 150, no more. That needs to be the range. And a high yield for the farmer, able to set 15 to 25 peppers on one plant. That would be the perfect pepper for the canning industry.
So you're pretty happy with the industry.
Oh, my
now.
Goodness. We have so much left work to do. This, we got to live to be 150 years old to solve this thing, you know.
Right. And the And the issue, I think, is that we now have all these other uses for chilies, like you said, the pigments. And my closing thought is you can put pepper pigments on a pig, but it's still carne adobada.
Okay, I can't top that. I can't touch that unless, Jeff, you want to wait in, but we'll quick 10 seconds.
Well, I always say that any kind of a crop production system is a function of art and science. And this is a good example of what we've discussed today. Mm-hmm. There's an art to walk that fine line in the management and kind of get a feel of the personality of the plant. And what we're trying to do is find a little more science, bring the science into it, and quantify the process.
There you have it. Jeff Silvertooth, professor and head of the Plant Sciences Department at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Ed Curry, farmer and owner of the Curry Seed and Chili Company in Pierce. And Gary Nabham, social scientist at the University of Arizona, author of Why Some Like It Hot, Food, Genes, and Cultural Diversity. Gentlemen, thank you all.
Thank you very much.
For taking time to be with us. You're welcome. Stay with us. We're going to shift gears and come back and talk about astronomy and why Arizona skies are so great for it. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.